It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you. Marilyn Mandala Schlitz is somebody who is really, when I looked at her resume online, it just sort of blew me away. She's a Renaissance person. She's committed to doing the work that we need for social transformation. She's studying the boundaries of consciousness in all of its dimensions. She has a degree in philosophy. She's also an anthropologist with a PhD. She was a postdoctoral research scholar at Stanford. She's published so many articles, you can't almost count them. And they're in many journals across the country, also lots of magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times. She's been on the teaching staff at Harvard, University of New Mexico, Stanford, Trinity University, I'm sure other places that aren't even on the list here. She was on the national, is an advisory member of the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine for a number of years, is on the editorial board of the journal Advances, is on the board of directors of Esalen. She's the author of two books that I highly recommend. One, Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life, and the second book, Consciousness and Healing, Integral Approaches to Mind-Body Medicine. And, of course, she's the president of the Institute for Noetic Sciences, which is exploring the frontiers of consciousness in multiple ways of knowing that include intuition, reason, and senses. With my great pleasure to introduce to you my friend, Marilyn Schlitz.
Well, thank you all for coming out. I know that there are many, many, many things that can take up our time and our energies, and I really appreciate you coming out and also to the Commonwealth Club for sponsoring this. I want to set a context for the conversation, give you a little background about the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the work we're doing, and then talk specifically about a model of transformation that we've developed out of our programs. In that process, I think that we can reflect on the times we're living in. And I think there is absolutely no question for any of us that this is an extraordinary moment to be alive. And really, never before have so many worldviews, belief systems, ways of engaging reality come into contact. You know, on the one hand, we have the enormous successes of Western science. We have, you know, an orbiting space station and a cloned cat named Carbon Copy and a computerized chess champion named Deep Blue. And on the other hand, we now have access to the world's wisdom and spiritual traditions in a way that was once available only to a very small group of adepts somewhere in the Himalayas or perhaps deep in the Amazon. And now, in the course of a Google search, you can begin to reveal to yourself some of the insights that have come from thousands of years of inquiry. And so it is a time of great convergence. It's also a time of enormous complexity. So how many people here can relate to this picture? It's really a time, I think, when all of us are challenged to multitask in ways that really we've never experienced before. And the truth is that in this period that we're living in this year, the next year, we are generating more new data than in any point in the entire history of human civilization. We are living in the emergence of this huge unfolding of information, of insight, of, you know, convergence of difference. And all of that, I think, leads to a need for thinking through what it is that gives us meaning and purpose. I love this cartoon. Remember when everything used to be nice and solid? We can kind of think with this spirit of nostalgia of the day when it all made sense and we weren't trying to figure out Newtonian physics and quantum mechanics and deep spirituality and the multitasking of taking our kids to carpool or whatever it is that is taking up our time. There's a way in which all of us are groping for meaning and trying to make sense of something that honestly does not make sense. The idea that there is this great convergence of ideas and worldviews, it's unprecedented. So how is it that we navigate? How is it that we respond to the fact that in addition to snail mail, we have voicemail and email? And did anybody come here based on Twitter? Anybody read my Twitters? No? Okay. Anyway, I think all of us are feeling compelled to begin to question our own lives and what gives us meaning, what's purposeful, and how is it that we can navigate these outside complexities while recognizing that perhaps the great frontier is really our own inner capacities. So how do we manage this complexity? What are the skills and capacities that are being called of us as we move into the 21st century? And how is it that we can move from simply coping with this overload to really embracing it with a spirit of human flourishing and also our relationship to a broader sense of the whole? So just a little bit about the Institute of Noetic Sciences as it relates to this conversation. And we're an organization that was founded actually nearly 40 years ago by one of the Apollo 14 astronauts, Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar Mitchell was trained at MIT, had a great deal of confidence in the physicalist, materialist, this is reality paradigm. And he had the job of manning the little lunar module that took them from the Apollo capsule to the moon and back. And so when his part of the mission was complete, he describes having the window seat on the way home. And he had this perspective of looking out at planet Earth, suspended in the vastness of space and all the beauty and majesty of what that represented. And he had two experiences. The first was one of deep pain. Here he looked at this beautiful planet, and he realized that there's nothing inherent in this world that represents the kind of conflict and turmoil that we live with on a daily basis. There's nothing on this planet that inherently says we have racism or ethnic conflict or the kinds of divisiveness that we've taken for granted. And so it was really this revelation for him that perhaps the source of suffering wasn't anything out there, but really something about what's in here. And really beginning to think about shifting the program from an Apollo program of exploration of outer space to what would it look like if we created an Apollo program for inner space and really begin to understand the powers and potentials of our consciousness and our worldview and the ways in which we guide our lives based on beliefs and assumptions. The second experience he had was really of profound wonder. And he had this epiphany of entanglement. And he felt in this moment of looking at this beautiful planet in the context of the solar system that there was something about the molecules in his body that fundamentally connected him with the entire universe, and that there was no separation, and that perhaps this idea that we're going to manipulate a world out there to our own advantage was an illusion. And again, is it possible that we could direct our attention, all the rigor and the discernment that went into the Apollo program, mastering outer space, is it possible we could take that same resourcefulness and direct it toward understanding ourselves? And so that's what he did. He created the Institute of Noetic Sciences in 1973 with the mission to advance the science of consciousness and human experience to serve individual and collective transformation. So what is it that we mean by this idea of transformation? And what is it that we're being called to? This is a beautiful image, and you'll see a set of images in this talk from the Institute of Noetic Sciences campus in Petaluma, California, and I encourage and invite all of you to visit us there. By consciousness transformation, we're talking about profound shifts in our awareness that result in long-lasting changes in the way we experience and relate to ourselves, to each other, and to the world. And it also relates to the shared worldview that cultures represent. And so when we're talking about this concept of worldview shift and sort of paradigm shift, it seems very simple. What could be easier than changing our mind or changing our perspective? And yet what we discover is that it is really probably one of the most challenging things we're ever going to want to do. I thought we could just do a little experiment, if you're so inclined. And this is an example of the kind of perspective shift we're talking about. So if you took your finger and pointed it up to the sky, and if you were willing to do it and try it for yourself, and rotate your finger in a clockwise direction, okay? And keep watching it as it's rotating in a clockwise direction, okay? And very slowly, if you would, bring it down to your chest. and look at the direction of your finger. Okay, what direction is it going in? It's going counterclockwise. What changed? Did you change the direction of your finger? No. If you didn't get it, we'll have a tutoring session later. The point is that it's about our perspective. And as human beings, we're meaning-making creatures, and we have the capacity to ascribe meaning to our experiences. And in that process, we also have the capacity to shift our perspective such that we can see it from a different point of view. And that's really what we're thinking about when we talk about transformation. Obviously, there are different types of transformation. If you think about science or discovery, innovation in business, there are these kinds of what have been called minor or technical kinds of innovations or changes that are basically sort of building block reconfigurations. And that's not really what we're talking about when we're talking about sort of a major shift in our awareness or our consciousness. Obviously, when we think about something like transformation, it's clear that it's not all la-la land. When we think about consciousness transformation and movements that facilitate transformation, we know that things like, you know, Nazi Germany and the Jonestown Massacre or Al-Qaeda training programs all represent a kind of consciousness transformation training program. And so it's important, I think, as we're dealing with this concept of transformation, to recognize that it's not all positive. It's not all good. In fact, Phil Zimbardo, he's a professor from Stanford. I just had the opportunity to visit with him before I came here tonight. He's got a great book called The Lucifer Effect, in which he talks about how there isn't really good or evil. There are situations in which good people do evil things. And so here he is describing an example. This was a Nazi doctor. Mass killing was the unyielding fact of life to which everyone was expected to adapt. This becomes a worldview issue that situates our consciousness and that obviously begins to shape us. So how is it that we can recognize all the forces that impinge upon our psyches, impinge upon our awareness, and begin to promote this kind of positive transformation, a perspective on life that promotes greater depth, meaning, pro-social engagement, resilience in the face of change? So the kinds of transformation I'm going to talk about tonight is not these sort of limited, narrow concepts of inclusive as opposed to exclusive, in-group, out-group, but really the idea that there is a kind of meta worldview that we're being called to that invites us to hold the complexities of the moment. Another beautiful picture from the campus. So in our research, we were interested in studying this idea of transformation and really beginning to understand what stimulates these positive transformations. When in fact, you know, we see many opportunities for good people to do bad things on a daily basis, what is it that would lead us to have this kind of positive life-affirming experience? What are the predictors? And then if people have these transformational experiences, what are the outcomes? What moderates these experiences? For whom? Under what circumstances? Is sitting meditation good for everyone? In fact, it's not. So how do we begin to understand what are the right practices, facilitators, for what kinds of people? And why and how, under what circumstances, does one kind of transformational experience work and not another? So in our research path, as we have explored this over the last 15 years, I can say just as way of background, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, in the 60s and 70s, at a time when this nation was at war with itself. And clearly it was a race war, but it was a class war, an ethnicity war, and ultimately I came to see it was a clash of paradigms kind of war or conflict, and really that it was about worldview. And as then an undergrad at Wayne State University in Detroit, I had this great experience of discovering two books. One was Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And that book, I have to say, totally changed my life. Did it affect you? And it liberated me in the sense that I realized that the context I was living in and the container that was defining my experience was a construction. And that, in fact, paradigms are socially embedded and that not only are they not fixed, but historically, even in the context of science, they have changed over time. Our very concept of reality is morphing as we speak, as we engage one another. That's a really profound and interesting idea. And the second book I read was called Psychic Exploration, and it was by Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, 1977. And that book set me off on an odyssey that has guided my life. And in fact, it was because I realized that there are powers and potentials within our consciousness that can help us. And as we begin to engage in a scientific enterprise, perhaps we can begin to understand better what it is that will serve the future of humanity. In about 12 years ago, we were approached by a very successful, no-nonsense, definitely not New Age woo-woo kind of business guy who came in, and he said that he had had a powerful transformative experience, and it was about 10 years earlier. It had so changed his life, his relationships with his loved ones, his colleagues, his engagement with his whole livelihood, and in a way that was really positive, that he wanted to know, was there something weird about him? Or was it something that other people had had as well? And as we dug into the literature, actually this is about 15 years ago we started this, there wasn't a whole lot in terms of the science of positive transformation. There was a lot about pathology. There was a lot about delusion and psychosis. But when people described these kind of epiphany openings, they weren't really celebrated other than with Abe Maslow or Erickson or a couple of pioneers that were looking at the ways in which we can, you know, gravitate and navigate our lives in better ways. And so he started us on a process that ultimately led to a number of other folks coming in to help and a series of projects where we investigated in depth masters from 60 different world traditions, talking with them about transformation. We surveyed, based on the qualitative work we did with the masters, we created a survey instrument and then could administer that to average householders to compare what's the average person's life experience around this transformational journey with the masters who actually have dropped off out and lived in a cave for 10 years. So we were able to then calibrate those two. We engaged in a longitudinal 18-month project and now are currently doing a number of projects on the psychophysiology of transformation. In our work, we've looked at different traditions. We've looked at Eastern contemplative traditions that are based in a rich lineage. We've looked at Western Christian traditions that also are birthed in a long history. We've looked at the ancient indigenous traditions. And then we've also interviewed a number of people who were what we called the emergent new form of transformation. And that is the Stan Grofs with holotropic breathwork or Michael Harner on shamanic work. Or I want to just acknowledge George Leonard, who died today and who was a very dear friend and absolutely a champion of this topic of transformation. And I think he would enjoy having his name offered here in the Commonwealth Club tonight. He wrote a book in the 70s about transformation and, again, how it is we can move from inner to outer. So all of that was part of our research and ultimately published in our book and the DVD, which is 9 practices from different traditions. I mentioned that to say that out of that, we have distilled a kind of model that we think is helpful for understanding the transformational process and, in particular, this kind of positive transformation. So we call it a noetic sciences change model, and we say that because we believe from our data that the most effective way of stimulating a life-changing worldview shift is through some kind of direct noetic experience. So, okay, I know that at least half of you in the room want to know what is noetic. So, thank you. Stand up and be counted. This is a quote from William James. It was in 1902, I believe. Noetic, states of insight into depths of truth, unplumbed by the discursive intellect. They are illuminations, revelations, full of significance and importance, all inarticulate though they remain, and as a rule, they carry with them a curious sense of authority. We don't write like that anymore. But it's a beautiful notion that there is this inner wisdom. There are these insights, call them intuition, call them higher creativity, call them that sense of what is right for me in my own life that I can't really describe to anyone else, but that you can be sure is guiding my behaviors and my practices. These are the kinds of noetic experiences that, because they're not easily measurable or manipulatable, often have not been studied by conventional science. What we found here, I'm going to just slip back here for a second, is that the vast majority of, first of all, the triggers, the catalysts for these kinds of positive transformations can be almost anything. We heard from a woman who described washing her dishes, looking out the window, and suddenly feeling her connection to nature in a whole new way. We heard from a Vietnam vet who described an experience of profound consciousness transformation on the battlefield when he suddenly was watching his colleagues being gunned down, and a Muslim prayer came to a Christian man in that moment and sustained him under tremendous adversity, and he was able to then use that to propel his life for years after. So there are ways in which there are positive stimulus. People walk in nature and have this sense of something wonderful. But the vast majority of transformation comes out of pain. It comes out of some kind of suffering, some disruption of the steady state. And so the great opportunity of the time we're living in is what a great thing that people are feeling it. You know, it's great. Rachel Remen, we interviewed her for our Living Deeply book. She's an oncologist and a wonderful poet. She describes suffering, loss, the unexpected encounter with the unknown. All have potential to initiate a shift in perspective, a new way of seeing familiar with new eyes, ways of seeing the self in a completely new way. It shuffles a person's values like a deck of cards. A value that's been on the bottom of the deck for many years turns out to be the top card. And so in this, you realize that it is our opportunity and our choice to take the complexities of the moment that we're living in, the challenges and the confusions, and begin to use them to our advantage. But as we think about these noetic experiences, we know that, as I said, it is not easy to make these kind of fundamental life changes. And it's often the case that if you don't have an environment or a social group that supports you in exploring something like an out-of-body experience or a mystical opening or a sense of unity of consciousness, that it's probably just going to go away. It's not going to be reinforced in ways that allow you to grow into it. And there are lots of ways in which we have created in our psyches, in our psychology, in our sociology, barriers to integrating new perspectives. Piaget, the famous developmental psychologist, talked about assimilation versus accommodation. How easy it is, if we come upon new information, to try and assimilate it into our existing worldview. Well, if I just nudge it a little bit here or there, I can make sense of this, and I don't have to radically change anything. Versus accommodation, where you begin to really create a new form. So he used this example that I think is very sweet of a child in a developmental stage where they see a zebra, and their conceptual framework says, stripy horse. This is a stripy horse. And you can try to your wit's end to convince this child that zebra is a different category than horse, but they don't see it that way because they have a worldview and a set of categories that allow them to make sense of it. And then one day, suddenly they'll see it. Ah, I can accommodate that now there's a horse and a zebra, and they're different things. So there is a way in which we see the ego represents striving of human beings to understand themselves and the world they live in by fitting new experiences into their current meaning system. Overall, the ego labors mightily to create and maintain coherence and vigorously defends against dissident stimuli. So there are all kinds of barriers as we think, why haven't we solved healthcare? Why isn't the educational system reformed? Why can't we create peace? It's because in a lot of ways we are actually hardwired to prevent innovation from happening. So there is some new research I've just discovered in the last couple of weeks where these scientists are studying scientists and how it is that they adapt to new data that either conforms or refutes their pre-existing hypotheses. Studies of scientists and science students shows that the brain learns more about data that supports existing theory, but resists new data that doesn't support our pre-existing assumptions. So this isn't just something that's psychological, but based in a series of experiments, what they were able to show is that you confront people with information that's compatible with their belief system, the learning centers of the brain light up. They're like, okay, yeah, I get that. As soon as you give them something that confronts the pre-existing hypotheses, the error detection parts of the brain kick in and go, warning, warning, this is not compatible, and therefore you don't even process it. It just shuts down and inhibits the input of new information. This is right inside of us, right in the ways in which we are functioning. So they conclude, when people receive information that's inconsistent with their preferred theory, learning does not easily occur. And this is really important as we're thinking about redesigning our educational system for the future. And you think, well, we'll just give them more information. And it's not so simple. So we can think about, obviously, all of us. And if we had more time, I would love for us to be able to share our own personal stories of transformation. What triggered it for each of us in some way that, you know, compelled you to come out tonight and listen to this conversation? What excites your imagination? So there is a way in which we can overcome these barriers, and I'll talk a little bit about some of what that looks like. But oftentimes it then leads people to seeking. For Edgar Mitchell, when he came back from the moon and he'd had this profound experience, he didn't understand it. He had ultimately what he called a kundalini experience, a total enlightenment experience. But he had no idea, as an MIT-trained engineer, what any of that was about. And so he went on a search, and he explored different faith traditions, spiritual traditions, scientific research, and tried to find ways in which to calibrate. But the pitfall or the downside of that is continual seeking. We can find that our whole life is engaged in finding something out there. And again, not really integrating these experiences into our life. So then we can think about this change cycle and recognize that the teachers that we interviewed, by and large, told us that the most important thing for them personally, as well as their advice to others, is to find a practice. But what does that mean, to find a practice? Obviously, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. We were talking to a Catholic priest and a Wiccan witch, all in the same study. Think about the times of the Inquisition. That would not have been tolerated. We had people, as I said, from long lineage lines and people who were innovating, who were authoring their own spiritual path, their own practice. So what we tried to do is, in a spirit of pluralism, respect the differences across these very diverse traditions, and then to look for common denominators across all of them that could begin to translate into information or educational curricula for others. And what we found were five qualities or characteristics that were uniform across these different traditions. And one was intention, setting the intention to invite positive change into our lives. And yet we know the road to hell is paved with good intention. And so it's obviously not so simple as everything is just going to fall into my intention network. And in fact, what we're finding in terms of the science now is that setting one intention and expecting like a New Year's resolution to be manifest by the end of January, we don't even remember, is incremental tiny little steps. How can we set intention to make progressive change in our life? And to know that intention alone is not enough. It's about attention. Where is it that we're placing our attention? Is it on the glass half empty or the glass half full? In the cognitive neurosciences now, there's a tremendous amount of literature. Again, if we had more time, we could go into some of this, looking at things like inattentional blindness. Our culture and our expectations about the world actually influence what we're capable of seeing. And you can see there are a variety of different kinds of tasks. Those optical illusion tests where you can look at an embedded figure, those are examples of how it depends on where you place your attention, how then you experience reality. And so many of the transformational practices offer tools and technologies for gaining greater appreciation for our inner awareness. And it doesn't mean we're going to see everything at all times. We're not. But to become more resilient in our capacity to recognize that we're not seeing everything and we're simply not able to process everything. Repetition. Again, just like anything, exercise. If you want to work a new muscle group, you need to repeat the exercise. Well, the same is here in terms of developing new habits. We know that our brains lay down these neural pathways that structure what our habitual patterns are. So how is it that we can reconfigure these neural pathways, what's called neuroplasticity, to begin to reconfigure our brains to be more agile and responsive to the positive transformations we're inviting? And guidance. Again, most of the teachers that we interviewed had teachers. They had trusted others who helped to calibrate them along their path. But I think equally true here is the capacity to develop tools to trust your own inner guidance and to recognize that your own intuition, your own navigation system is profound and important. And then ultimately, in transformation, it isn't all about our ego striving to accomplish, but is ultimately a surrendering to what is so and a yielding to the world on its own terms. So finding a practice can also have its downside. We can see that people become habituated to doing the practice. And, you know, it's all about, well, I did this or that or the other, and that means I'm there and you're not. And we find that that is often the case for people who get caught in the loop of practice as the end in and of itself. And again, going back to the teacher interviews, most of the masters told us in various metaphors or analogies, it's about getting off the cushion. Sitting alone in your dojo is not enough. Sitting in the pew in your church on Sunday is not enough. It's got to be that we begin to embrace practice as part of our life, and that every day it's the relationship we have to the ticket taker, or more interestingly, to that challenging colleague at work who really knows how to push our buttons. How is it that we can begin to build a different relationship there? This is Sharon Salzberg, a Buddhist teacher. If we remember that our spiritual path is not just for ourselves alone and our own private satisfaction of having had a great experience, but it's about how we live every day, how we relate to our children, how we relate to our parents, how we earn a living, how we speak to one another, all the subtle little things we do. I had an experience for myself. I was driving down the road, and I like to tell people that I think road rage is a transformative practice. And, you know, I was driving in my car. My son was in the back seat, probably talking and, like, not wanting to do whatever it was we were doing in this moment. And we were on the way to his violin lesson, and there was a lady in the middle of the street walking with a dog carrier in one hand and a dog in the other, and she was totally blocking traffic. And I thought, what is she doing? What is wrong with her? And then I just thought, you know, here I am seeped in all this work. Something's wrong with her. And as soon as I flipped from that aggressive kind of what is she doing to hurt me to a sense of compassion, I could no longer feel the road rage. And suddenly it was like I slowed down, let her pass. You know, we were a little late, but, you know, so was the teacher. So life becomes practice. But in that process, we can also find that there is a seduction toward narcissism and toward that sense of it's all about how good I am, how virtuous I am, how much I'm making a difference. And that can be in itself a diversion. And so how is it that we move from this sense of my practice, my development, my transformation, my actualization, to recognizing that we're moving from this sense of this I position to a healthy we? And at the same time, it's vitally important that we recognize the profound beauty of individuation. So moving also from the we to a healthy me, because every one of us has a gift to offer, and we would not be doing service to the world to deny that. So it's a paradox and a kind of juxtaposition as we play the dynamic between the contribution and the experience of the I and the recognition that there's something more. And in fact, people begin to describe this profound sense of unitive experience that comes in what we call living deeply. And I would actually say that, you know, this change model is like a fractal, and it's not a linear process, and yet it is consistent with the kind of data that we saw in a certain pattern. But you may see yourself jumping around in different places on this matrix or this diagram. Ultimately, what we find is that in this process of positive, life-affirming transformation, there is an impulse toward generosity. It leads people to want to give back, to be generative, and to share what they've learned. And so it's about our collaboration with one another, coming from a healthy place of me into that sense of community and engagement. And so we like to think about this as an individual change model that represents transformation at the level of, you know, the I, but it also represents a kind of full systems model. And as you think about what it is that's being called for, you can hear it from politicians, you can hear it from educators, you can hear it from health professionals. Everybody's calling for change. What is it that's going to facilitate that kind of breakthrough in the institutions that are incapacitated? Well, it's not going to come from the politics of changing the policy. It's going to come from individuals creating new policy. It's going to come from breakthroughs in this cycle that ultimately lead to changes in systems. And so our work has very much become something as we are engaging in how to apply these kinds of ideas. We're launching a program called Just Health as a coalition of people engaged in reforming healthcare and looking at how we can create educational programs for health and healing practitioners that facilitate their own renewal, their own sense of discovery. One of the projects that we're launching right now is on afterlife cosmologies, where we're offering health professionals for end-of-life care a set of resources for engaging their patients and their clients in a conversation about what happens when you die? And what do different cultures tell us about that? And how is science approaching it? And why is this therapeutic? So all of that comes from the idea that there are individual change makers within these systems that in a dialectic represent the potential for change. The same is true for education. I'm going to come back and talk about that in closing, as well as then really thinking about how it is when you have our brains hardwired to resist, how is it we're expected to make profound, innovative change in business, in science, wherever it happens to be? Willis Harman was the past president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and he noted, no economic, political, or military power can compare with the power of a change of mind. By deliberately changing their images of reality, people are changing the world. And it's really simple. And it's also really hard. And so at the end of the day, where does this lead us? Why is this important? I think that, as I said, we're all kind of looking for meaning. Really, I'm fine. It was just a fleeting sense of purpose. I'm sure it will pass. How is it that we can create a context that supports each other in the exploration of these new ways of thinking, new ways of being, new ways of engaging one another? So a big part of what's called for is us being with one another in a place of witness to our greatness, to the heroism that is in each individual under extraordinary or not so extraordinary circumstances. So goals of positive transformation, to create inner capacities that can match the complexities of the external world we're navigating in. How is it that we can stay grounded? How can we move from coping to flourishing? And so what are the steps for developing these ideas of positive transformation? How can we overcome the barriers that limit our capacities? Well, first, it's developing tools and technologies to access our inner authority. Contemplative practice, reflective practice, quiet walks in the woods can all offer an opportunity. You know, taking a bath with intention can become a practice. One of the things we saw is that, you know, it doesn't have to be formal. If people do it with those principles of intention, attention, repetition, and guidance, you can begin to see that gardening or carpooling can become a kind of practice. Questioning the assumptions, questioning the dogma that absolutely gives us certainty in a moment, and then we find is in opposition to someone else's position. How is it that we can find the engagement with another position that invites curiosity, invites that sense of questioning, allows us to begin to examine multiple perspectives? Maybe my perspective isn't all right. And once you give yourself the opening, the brain responds better. Developing life practices, whatever the form is, and really giving ourselves the space and the nurturing to fail and to stumble and to be rude or unappreciative. You know, as long as we pay attention to when that moment happens so that we can begin to modify and reflect and question why we did what we did. The kind of emotional and social intelligence that's being called for from Danny Goleman and others. And finding supportive communities that will allow the engagement in these ideas. And ultimately, as I said, there is a deep call to service and giving back. And as we begin to reflect on our own personal transformation, how is it that we can live into it in ways that are pro-social for all concerned? So just very quickly, one of the projects that I am most passionate about is translating this work into curriculum for young people. And so we've had a 3-year grant from the Marin Community Foundation and others to help us to create a curriculum around what we're calling worldview intelligence. And it's an opportunity. Right now we're in 4 schools in Oakland piloting 15 lesson plans. And it's been a profound experience. We've worked in a couple of private schools in Marin and Sonoma County. We've had this opportunity now to be in inner city Oakland and to feel the challenges and the differences and to watch the profound, deep, life-enhancing changes that are happening for these young people. The courses that we're doing right now are 9th through 12th grade. And hearing these young people who have never had anybody really listen to them, who have never learned the skills of listening to one another, who are involved with a kind of curiosity. And one of the things we love to do is blow their minds. We bring in all these optical illusions and cognitive tests that allow them to play with, you know, their assurances and begin to reflect that maybe, you know, maybe there's another way of seeing things. This is a beautiful quote. If you observe a really happy man or woman, you'll find them building a boat, writing a symphony, educating their son, growing double dahlias in their garden. They'll not be searching for happiness as if it were a collar gold button that rolled under the cupboard in his bedroom. He'll have become aware that he is happy in the course of living 24 crowded hours a day. So it becomes an opportunity for each of us to think about being agents of change, acting as hospice workers for a dying system that ultimately ceases to work in all kinds of domains of our experience, and also to serve as midwives for something new that's waiting to be born, the opportunity to embrace a new form, a new worldview, a new kind of consciousness. And ultimately, for myself, and I think for all of us, if we think about that navigation of the complexities, and, you know, how often do we take time to stop and smell the roses? Can we do that? So I want to really acknowledge a lot of people, my colleagues, Cassandra Veaton, Tina, Liz, a number of donors who've supported us, the beautiful photography that I was able to show you, and ultimately that's our research team right there. And I just want to say, here is my email address. Here's the website for the Institute of Noetic Sciences. We're launching a global engagement campaign, doing a world tour beginning in soon, April, I guess. And we have these educational programs. We have a retreat center that's a beautiful place if you have opportunities or need for retreat facilities. We have a lab. For those of you who read Dan Brown's new book, The Lost Symbol, the heroine of the book is the head of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Gotta love that. And we have he in his book describes the cube, which is this really cutting edge research lab where great innovative breakthroughs are happening. And we have that. So come visit our campus. And I would just love to hear from you now. We've got maybe 10 minutes.
Thank you, Marilyn, for your inspiring and transforming talk. And now I'd like to have Len Saputo give a few comments, and then we'll open the floor to questions.
First of all, I haven't heard it. Wow. Takes care of that. It's not a Mac, is it? That's a transformational change we don't need. All right, thank you. I'm a dangerous walker. It's not often you get a chance to hear something so beautifully put from someone who has such a deep knowledge of transformation of all types. And she's really telling us what Benjamin Franklin said, that if everybody's thinking the same thing, nobody's thinking. And so here's an opportunity to ask somebody who has put together the aspects of who we are, our intuition, our reason, and our senses to be able to maybe extend the boundaries of how we think, extend the boundaries of humanity, to look forward to how we do social transformation. And so this is a good time to open it back up to questions to Marilyn. We don't often get somebody who is such an expert in this area, so questions are what we really want. Maybe another time we can do comments when there's more time. So, Marilyn, back to you.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you can comment on the idea that we're in a time of increasing complexity right now, and that some of the, or maybe the problems in the world that we're facing are beyond our present capacity to resolve, and that possibly the complexity and the circumstances that we're faced with right now in the world are actually impelling us towards a transformation in our consciousness.
If I understand the gist of that, I totally think the times are calling us, inviting us, compelling us to a great and profound transformation. I think it is part of an evolutionary sequence. John White, who was one of the founders of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, talked about Homo noeticus. How is it that we can evolve? How can we evolve to that next level of our awareness and our capacity? But I think more than thinking about our own individual evolution, it's really time to think about the evolution of our social groupings and how it is that we can recognize that each of us, you know, and the internet provides a great resource for that, that we can begin to share in social networks ways of shifting the paradigm. So I'm very, actually, you know, for the days when I wake up cynical, but largely I am optimistic that we have the capacities within us. And one of the things I think we're seeing right now is more and more people being called to engage these questions. I mean, just take Dan Brown's book. The book has sold like 4 million copies. It's going to be a feature film. This is not some Northern California phenomenon. This is actually very mainstream. People are in it, and they're interested, and they're buying the book, you know? So I think that there are a lot of people who are at this kind of tipping point where they're eager to find the nourishment that would allow them to give back in ways that ultimately, I think, can shift all of those various institutions that we're struggling with. Thank you. See, John in the back.
Thanks for your presentation. I like your graph. And I mentioned in the very beginning part of that where you have a noetic experience and then an option is there's a fork in the road to deny the experience. And it seems kind of a fundamental fork in the road, a point, and what have you found are sort of the factors that affect that point of divergence, you know, whether you go with the experience or to deny it?
Well, I think that, again, those sort of principles of what one can do to facilitate it, I think it's really important. Many, many people talked about how easy it is to forget. Brother David Stendelrast, for example, is one of the teachers that we interviewed. He's Benedictine monk, and he came back from Africa where he had experienced clean drinking water. And he came home, and he was, like, turning the tap on, and he was like, oh, I'm so grateful. You know, and he was able to really bring that to his awareness very easily because he'd just come back from Africa. And then within a couple of days, he realized he'd habituated to it. And so he took these little yellow stickums, and he put them all over his house. And then he started moving them around whenever he found himself habituating. Or Cassie likes to talk about, you know, the little bobble-headed Buddha that people put on their dashboard. Well, she used to find that very, you know, distasteful. And then started to realize as we were digging into this that little reminders can help us. So once we've had an opening and we have found some way of setting intention toward a goal, it's so easy to slip up. It's so easy to slip up. And so that's where, you know, like-minded community, it's actually where I think the Institute of Noetic Sciences fulfills a really important function for people. We have the way of validating those noetic experiences, providing reliable information, offering an array of different kinds of practices for people to explore and experiment with without dogma or assertion. We have these community groups, 300 community groups all over the world. So if people want to go and find like-minded conversation, they can do it. And we're really gearing up with this world tour to begin to offer some tools and toolboxes, toolkits that will help leaders in communities to engage these ideas. So I think it's a complex question. There's no simple answer. Thank you. Okay.
Yes, you did mention that the ego or the subconscious is going to resist any change. And you mentioned five good things, repetition, intention, things such as that. Now, do you sit down with your ego, like, for 15 minutes a day to talk to it? What do you actually do to get the ego to make the change?
I think it's paying attention. I mean, there are people in this room that are probably more skilled at answering that question than I am. But I think a big step in the right direction is allowing yourself enough quiet to ask the question, to engage the conversation, to begin to restory the ego. Phil Zimbardo, who I just met with, he's got this Heroes Project. And what he wants kids to do is redefine themselves as heroes. And to recognize that the majority of people are not going to make these kinds of changes. Bob Keegan talks about how these kind of more integral, transformative worldviews are actually pretty unusual. It's not like everybody. But I think that as we're looking at the curriculum for these kids and seeing that in the course of 3 weeks, these kids were able to gain some new insights into their own insights. That's what I would say. It's like beginning to just turn the lens. Instead of thinking I'm dedicating my life to what's out there, can I take 15 minutes to focus on what's in here and to do that with a real sense of rigor?
So you actually take the 15 minutes and sit down and go
into
yourself?
So there are many kinds of practices. You know, for myself, I spend a bath, taking a bath with a candle and a very calm, like after a really busy day, if I can take that time to just center. There was a gentleman over here, too, when you're coming back this way. Thank you. It can be anything. It can be gardening. It can be taking a walk. It can be going to a meditation class. It can be yoga. It can be Christian prayer. It can be anything if it's done with those qualities that invite the kind of positive, life-enhancing, pro-social transformation that you're holding. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a question. Most of my transformative experiences come out of pain, as you mentioned. And what I've found is since then, I have embraced the process of suffering. And it seems to lead to more. Is there a kind of a more transformative experiences? Because what happens is if it works, then you do it again and again and again. And it becomes like a kind of a, like a physical endeavor. How much can you take? Is there some kind of a tradition in that or something? Or am I just out of my mind?
Zen? No, I don't know. That was smart alecky. There are traditions, and I think that there are many traditions that say embrace the suffering, understand it, develop equanimity such that it doesn't drive you. You are sitting with it. It was really clear in terms of the interviews with the masters that it isn't about approaching every day as a giddy, funny, this is just a riot kind of thing. It was really, this is what is so. And how can I create the internal resilience to allow myself not to be overwhelmed by all of that, but to really recognize there are practices within myself that can help me to maintain the balance. So nobody told us you're going to be happier. It isn't a secret to happiness. It's a secret to, I don't know, a secret, it's like right out there, to equanimity, to balance, and to a greater sense of emotional consistency and regulation. I think that's kind of a lot where it's going. And then ultimately, it's going toward an enlightened state where, you know, we are at one with what is all. And, you know, people talk about the non-dual consciousness or these kinds of experiences that ultimately lead to periods of deep joy. But, you know, whatever you're doing, if you say it's leading you to feel more suffering, I would suggest reflect on the practice so that you can begin to maybe make some calibrations there. If it's increasing your suffering, I think I would look to see if there's some ways that you may be wanting to calibrate.
For we who are the seniors in this room, the older ones, who have had a longer period of socialization, and for many of us, change becomes a very uncomfortable feeling because of the rigor in which our socialization has occurred. What is the attitude of the Institute toward enhancement assistance? such as mushrooms, LSD, ayahuasca, mm-hmm. Those types of native practices, do they contribute to breaking through that barrier of socialization?
There is absolutely no question that for some of the people, in terms of it being a transformative experience, that using these kind of plant medicines can be profound. We're co-sponsoring the MAPS conference. I'm trying to think when it is. It's coming up in the spring. And it's a group of scientists that are doing very serious research around the transformative potentials of entheogens. So if you check out the Institute of Noetic Sciences, noetic.org website, that will be posted soon because we've just made the decision to co-sponsor it. So, yeah. And we also did a wonderful project. It was called the Psychedelic Elders Project. And we looked at and interviewed in depth and brought together a group of the people who were the founders of the science of psychedelics. And it was, you know, Joel Elkies and Michael Herner and Ralph Metzner and a variety of these folks. And really engaged them in what were the qualities. And you know what we found is that it's really interesting. We've done this now, a number of these kind of focus groups with the masters, and they are so lonely that all they wanted to do was like, brother, you know, man, I'm so alone. And the same thing when we were doing the focus groups with the transformational teachers, so many tears flowed just by hearing other people's stories and by other people hearing their stories. And these were the masters. So I think there's a lot of room for potential to help build supportive community to allow people just to share their stories, you know. But thank you for that question. Okay? I don't know how long you...
I'll go
on all night, so you have to stop.
Having read the Dan Brown book, which, without getting into it, was serendipitous to our little group being here tonight, one of the characters, I'm not sure if it was the head of ION, said, when there is a period of great advancement positively, there is an equal attempt to squelch that. Is there or are there organizations in the quote-unquote scientific community that do think this is, to use your phrase, a little bit too woo-woo to be considered science?
No question. I've had the privilege, for example, at the National Institutes of Complementary and Alternative Medicine at the NIH, and I have been one of the people who helped to initiate RFPs, or requests for proposals, that were for innovative new approaches. What constitutes innovation at the NIH is a very different story from how I define it. I can tell you that. And there are tremendous influences and forces that resist all of this. And again, I don't mean to beat my own drum here, but to say I think that there's something very, I want to say, sacred about having places like the Institute of Noetic Sciences, there aren't a lot of them, that become a bastion for exploration, not an assertion of this is how it is, but a place to explore in a kind of open-ended way. And I think about it almost like I think about indigenous knowledge. You know, people, the elders who hold the knowledge of the plants, for example. You know, a lot of the young people, the next generation, are not interested. They've become modernized or seduced by all the other things. And so there's an eradication of a wisdom tradition if we're not careful. And I think the same is true about these kind of alternative models, that if we're not careful, there is a way in which the dominant physicalist materialist paradigm is almost like a steamroller. And I think there is a need for organizations, you know, to be able to stand up. And another just piece, and I won't go on about this, but the brains of iconoclasts are actually different than the brains of the average person. And the average person, actually, I can't tell you what the name of the brain place is. It's been a while since I read this study. But there are actually pain centers in the brain that get stimulated in the average person when you're out of harmony with the group. Iconoclasts don't have that. They actually don't have that pain reaction. So it's not like we all have to go be, you know, these autonomous selves that are iconoclast self-defining, but to be able to help young people to define more of their own individual identity such that they can think out of the crowd, and then also to stimulate role models, because we also know from neuroscience the mirror neurons create a lot of what's happening. We're modeling all the time. And so how is it that we can create new models that will allow young people to see other alternatives, you know, that aren't painful. Like, I don't have to be just completely marching to my own drummer, but I can begin to see a kind of social context that will support me that's different than joining a gang or being involved in violence.
Here's the last question.
Okay. Where is it?
Well, I don't know, but you mentioned George Leonard dying today. And for people who are older, I think the Carter and the book, The Life We're Given, is an excellent practice to begin with if you don't have a practice. And there are enough, I think, ideas in the Carter that you could take your own practice out of it. So I don't know how you think about that.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that is a wonderful note to end on. The Life We Are Given, it's by George Leonard and Michael Murphy. It's a set of practices. There is a group. It's called Integral Transformative Practice. It's actually the group we did the 18-month longitudinal study with, looking at, does transformational practice improve health outcomes psychologically and physically? And we actually did find that, yes, there were significant measurable changes in a positive direction as a result of the ITP practice, and particularly for people who started out high neurotic. So I don't know if anybody relates to that, but anyway, there's hope for all of us, I guess, is the point. Anyway, I really appreciate all of you and the efforts and the work that you're doing in the world, so thank you for your time.
Before we close, Marilyn's going to have a book signing on two of her books. One is Living Deeply, Transformative Practices from the World's Wisdom Traditions, and her other book, Consciousness and Healing, Integral Approaches to Mind-Body Medicine. And if you go through these doors, that's where where it will be. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Marilyn, for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you for your beautiful book. Do people know about, he has a great book, remind me of the title. It's Transforming Healthcare.
A Return to Healing.
A Return to Healing.
Marilyn wrote the foreword.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.